Support for the World's podcast comes from Goldman Sachs. To learn about developments currently shaping markets, industries, and the global economy, subscribe to the firm's podcast, Exchanges at Goldman Sachs, available on iTunes and Stitcher.
The gang violence that binds the U.S. and El Salvador, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Gangs in the U.S. and El Salvador offer members a sense of belonging, and both governments need to offer alternatives.
Until they provide those opportunities to those kids that need them, and they give them the hope and the sense of safety and belonging, you know, that these kids need, the gangs are just going to continue filling those voids.
Plus, President Obama heads to Hiroshima as Japan and the U.S. try to figure out how to talk about the past.
Societies have to decide, whether consciously or subconsciously, how much you remember and how much you put aside.
And a survivor of the Bataclan in Paris remembers the man who helped him and others escape.
He's a guy who managed to get up, and he went back in.
That's all today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. What happens in Central America doesn't always stay in Central America. It also has an impact here in the United States. And that's where we start things today on the show, specifically how gang violence in El Salvador has repercussions here in the U.S. That violence has pushed many Salvadorans to flee their country and come north, or to send their children alone on that journey to the U.S.-Mexico border. A huge factor behind all this are the street gangs in El Salvador and the unraveling of a truce between the country's two main gangs. That's led to a new spike in El Salvador's murder rate. And the current government has responded by arresting several people who were involved in, get this, negotiating that truce back in 2012. Sounds crazy, right? More on that in a moment. First, let's go back a few years to hear what it was like when rival gang members actually agreed to sit face-to-face to make a deal.
These guys have attacked each other's families, and some of the crimes are absolutely horrific. So you can imagine the reluctance to get into the same room together.
That's Adam Blackwell, a former official with the Organization of American States, the OAS. He worked with the committee that guaranteed the truce.
These guys are, you know, hated each other. Just getting them in the same room, despite the odio, as we say in Spanish, or the absolute palpable hatred, I think is one of the positive steps, getting them to look each other in the eye and realize that the level of barbarity had to stop.
Tell us about one of those moments where, you know, people who hated each other sat down in the same room. You were there. What was that like?
It was frightening, frankly. You know, we're in this prison room, and you had these guys who, you know, frankly, don't look like somebody you'd want to have tea with. And, you know, they were shaking their fist at each other. They wouldn't address each other by names. It was very tense. But calmer heads prevailed. And I think this is one of the lasting successes of this process, is that we were able to get them together. Could probably do so again if called upon.
Well, now El Salvador's government's going after the same people who brokered the truce. I mean, that sounds crazy. Why is that happening?
I don't think there's any other, you know, reason other than political. These folks working with me, well-intentioned, most of them fairly low to mid-level bureaucrats, I can assure you didn't break any laws in front of me or with me. We were just trying in a situation with high moral hazard to bring peace.
So now El Salvador's government has issued arrest warrants for 21 people who participated in negotiating the truce. Who are these 21 people?
Well, you've got Raul Mujango, who's the figurehead of this group. He's one of the core mediators, a former guerrilla FMLN member. The others are mostly former prison managers or even some of the psychotherapists who are trying to deal with some of the behavior issues. So it's a fairly eclectic group. As I said earlier, a sort of mid to lower level bureaucrats, which indicates to me that they're just trying to look for scapegoats and not come after me or the 11 mayors of the municipalities that were involved or the ministers who were involved or any of the other sort of senior political figures.
Do you think the truce gave gangs legitimacy they didn't deserve, you know, blurring the lines between authorities and criminals?
Oh, that's been one of the common criticisms. I mean, I think the gangs had legitimacy before. You know, they grew up in Los Angeles. They were deported back. They formed in El Salvador and other countries of Central America. They have their own recruiting mechanism, their own culture, their own discipline, their own sense of identity. Political parties and others had tried to negotiate with them in the past. So what we were doing really wasn't new or giving them any broader exposure than they'd had in the past. What we did do that was different was getting them all together in the same place and trying to find a parallel process for each of the gangs. So, you know, I don't buy that. I think, you know, they're almost 10% of the El Salvadorian population, if you think of their families and the multipliers. So, you know, these are a serious chunk of the population at any stage.
So, Adam Blackwell, what is the way out of this? I mean, how do you come to a solution to the violence in El Salvador?
Well, I think this should be a call to all of us in the United States and, you know, the international community in general to try and find strategies to stop what is essentially a civil war in El Salvador. I mean, 100 homicides over 100,000 makes El Salvador the most violent place on the planet, not called Syria. I would think something very helpful would be to stop deportations. I think this country is much better able to deal with violent gang members than El Salvador right now. And how much more El Salvador can take, how many more kids have to leave, how many more kids have to die or families be displaced, I don't know before the government and civil society and citizens in general will try something new.
Adam Blackwell, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you.
Adam Blackwell is a former official with the Organization of American States. He worked on the committee that guaranteed El Salvador's gang truce. As I mentioned earlier, threats from gangs are sending record numbers of Salvadoran teens and their families fleeing north, seeking safety here in the U.S. Salvadoran American Susan Cruz helps youth on the run from gangs in Central America build new lives in this country. Decades ago, Cruz herself was in one of those gangs. She says they have a long reach that extends even to those who've managed to flee to the United States.
Social media, the use of cell phones, that has really facilitated communication and made it real time. And when they come to the United States, there's always a way, you know, to be found. Unfortunately, unless someone can be in a situation that's similar to a witness protection program, a lot of the kids or their families who were being extorted or threatened are sometimes found here in the United States as well.
So say a kid from Central America gets to a town or a city here in the U.S., how are they going to know if there is a gang after them in this new place they're living in?
For example, we've had situations where asylees or asylee applicants in the United States stay in communication with family members in their home country or people that they know, and that's how they are found. I've had a situation with a young man who stayed in communication with his younger sister, and through her friends at school, they found him here in the United States, and they attempted to extort him again.
So let me get back. This kid arrives in the U.S. How do they know that gang is in the town they just settled in?
Immigrant communities tend to be pretty well connected, especially when it comes to kids. They arrive at a school. Immediately, all the other kids want to know who he or she is. And they start cross-referencing by cell phone numbers. You can look up someone's Facebook profile with their cell phone number alone. And so through the history of whatever activity they've had on social media, it's very easy to find people. And one of the things that I do with folks who are newly arrived, I basically do a very quick introduction to privacy settings and also about how much information they should or should not disclose so they are not found.
Yeah, kids who don't know that, though, must be really scared that they might be found, like too scared to even leave their house or go to school.
I think here in the United States, the biggest fear kids have is really with law enforcement because they seem to think that a police officer is the same as an immigration officer.
Susan, tell us a story of one teen that you've been working with recently who is really illustrative of what's going on.
This is a teenage girl who was being persecuted by local gang members in a town in El Salvador. She was left behind by her parents with a grandmother. And she was attending school, doing her thing. And by the time she turned 12, a local gang member took interest in her and started trying to romance her and, you know, wanted her to be his girlfriend. She turned him down, and he became more aggressive about it. He basically told her, you're going to be mine and no one else's. And he kept pursuing her and pursuing her until he was able to almost sexually assault her when she was walking home from school. She stopped going to school. Then paper notes with threats were slid under her grandmother's door. And this girl was terrified. She couldn't leave. Her grandmother was too old really to do anything. So she was basically sent by her family. And she came into the United States. She was apprehended at the border. She passed a credible fear interview, and she's now fighting her case in court. She's applying for asylum. The gang members have gone to the grandmother's house asking about the girl. And they've also indicated that for the grandmother to be okay, that someone's going to have to pay for her safety. Wow. So it's a situation that even if the kids leave, they have survivor's guilt when other relatives are left behind who are still facing threats of violence.
Could that girl like be the recipient of a text or Facebook message, like, we know where you are?
She was able to really keep her privacy settings, that she only connected with people that were trustworthy. And even then, people approached them asking about the girl's whereabouts. So it became known that the girl was in the United States. However, they have not been able to reach her. What they have been trying to do is they have tried, you know, to pressure the grandmother to pay an extortion fee for her safety.
Wow. Susan, you know these networks from the inside. How can we diminish the hold of the gangs on young people?
By giving them the opportunities that the gangs give them. Unfortunately, the governments of these countries don't see that. Gangs take the place of family, and gangs fill society's voids. And until these governments and society in general, particularly society that lives in middle and upper class neighborhoods who don't feel affected by this, until they provide those opportunities to those kids that need them, and they treat them like family, and they give them the hope and the sense of safety and belonging, you know, that these kids need, the gangs are just going to keep on continuing filling those voids.
Salvadoran American Susan Cruz helps youth on the run from gangs in Central America build new lives here in the U.S. Susan, good to speak with you again. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
A quick note now from another place still dealing with the effects of political violence. I'm talking about Northern Ireland and the decades known as the Troubles. Today, a ceremony took place in Belfast to honor the nurses who worked in the city during the Troubles. Olwyn Minford was one of them, and here, in her own words, is how she remembers that time, starting with her first day working at a Belfast hospital.
I remember it clearly. I was so excited and felt all my dreams had come true to be starting nursing at the Royal Victoria Hospital. We obviously grew up in a backdrop of conflict, you know, buses burning, rioting. It depended where you lived, really, how much exposure you had. But coming to the hospital, then you had really a lot more exposure. And I don't think we could have had any concept of what we might experience in the future. I think our normal was very abnormal, and we didn't really know that. The first time that I realised that was when I came for a brief spell to London in the 80s. And I worked in intensive care, and I wondered how I would manage in London. But actually, you know, I was sort of looking around wondering, when's it going to happen? There were no bomb blasts, you know, it was just really quiet. We had no formal debriefing, it's important to say that. So there were incidents all the time. They were commonplace, yes, gunshot wounds, bomb blast injuries. There was tremendous camaraderie, there was tremendous teamwork. There was some, you know, superb professionalism. When I look back, I feel really proud to have belonged to that time and worked with many of those people. It felt quite despairing at times. You couldn't see an end to it at that point in time. And I think now it's always great to be able to give other people hope and say it can come to an end, the acute carnage.
Olwyn Minford worked as a nurse in Belfast during the years of violence known as the Troubles. She was speaking there with our colleagues at the BBC. Minford and other nurses were honoured today at a special ceremony in Belfast. Who's the Taliban's new leader? That's up next here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. The Taliban in Afghanistan just announced its new leader. His name is Haibatullah Akhundzada. He succeeds Mullah Mansour, who was reportedly killed in a U.S. drone strike in Pakistan last weekend. I asked journalist Sune Engel Rasmussen in Kabul to tell us more about Haibatullah and what happens now.
Yeah, we don't know a lot about Mullah Haibatullah, actually. And I've been sort of looking into details about him all day. But what we do know is that he's around 50. He's born in Kandahar, the southern province of Afghanistan. And he fled to Pakistan during the Soviet invasion. And then he came back after that invasion and then popped up as a religious cleric and used to be chief of justice for the Taliban during their regime in the 90s. And in that role, he handed out decrees and issued fatwas ordering military operations, but also ordering executions and amputations and things like that as a chief justice. He is not, as far as I know, he doesn't have a lot of experience as a military commander, so his weight is more as a religious scholar and as a mediator.
Suni, you retweeted a statement from a Taliban spokesman who said that the new leader, Haibatullah, does not have a known photo of himself and does not want his picture taken. What do you make of that?
Actually, it turned out that there was a photo. Later, a photo emerged on different media outlets and was also confirmed by the same spokesman.
Were they trying to keep him hidden, his identity hidden?
No, I don't think so. I think maybe the spokesman is not always connected to the leadership. But as far as I know, as far as I've been told also by people in the Afghan government, this is the only known photo that exists of him, and it's a bit old. It's a couple of years old. His beard is now all white, people say. But more to the point, I think he has a reputation of being very conservative. And that's also why people thought there was no photo of him, because he's apparently against music, against the television and radio, and therefore also against cameras and having his photo taken. So he is a very conservative cleric.
What does that tell us?
And I think that tells us that we should probably look at the constellation of the whole Taliban leadership. And he has two deputies. One of them is the leader of the Haqqani network, which is notoriously violent branch of the Taliban. But I think what the Taliban are trying to do with Haibatullah is to calm this tension that's been since last summer when it was announced that their leader, a former leader, Mullah Omar, had been dead for 2 years. And I think Haibatullah is probably some sort of, people are going to be hoping at least for him to be a unifying candidate.
I mean, mafia boss is a pretty apt metaphor. The sales of opium poppy and heroin seem to be where the Taliban gets a lot of its revenue. What do you know about Haibatullah's control over that industry, and can we expect the Taliban to thrive?
I know that a lot of that trade was in the hands, and a lot of the money in the Taliban was in the hands of the Ishaqzai tribe, which was Mullah Mansour's tribe. And he was the one who was killed over the weekend in a U.S. Drone strike. And that's not Haibatullah's tribe. He's a Nurzai. But I don't know enough in detail about his connections to the money stream. Whether or not the Taliban will flourish, I think, the U.S. was hoping that the killing of Mullah Mansour is going to somehow coerce the Taliban to negotiate for peace all of a sudden. And I can't see that happening anytime soon. I think the Taliban will respond to this killing of their leader with retaliation. And I think even if a leader like Haibatullah would be favorable to peace, to engaging in the peace process, I think there's so many different commanders in so many different provinces in Afghanistan that getting a concerted effort from the Taliban behind any peace effort, it's going to take a long time.
Reporter Suna Engel Rasmussen in Kabul, Afghanistan. Thank you for your time.
You're welcome, Marco.
It's been 6 months since the terrorist attacks in Paris, and now a statement by the lead singer of the band that was playing at the Bataclan Theater has a lot of people talking. Most of the 130 people who died that night were at the Bataclan. Eagles of Death Metal frontman Jesse Hughes said in an interview that the venue's security guards may have been in on the attack and that he saw Muslims celebrating the assault in the streets of Paris. Those words were a disappointment for Bataclan survivor Ismail El Iraqi. He says if it were not for a Muslim security guard named Didi, many more would have died.
He's nothing like me, and he's nothing like Jesse, and he's nothing like anyone I've ever met, because he's a true life hero. He's a real life hero. He's a guy who, when he managed to get out, be in the street, and we all dreamed of that street, of that outside. He was out and he went back in. He went back in against all survival instinct, against everything that makes us animals, you see? And he reached inside of himself and he pulled himself towards what can make us, I don't know, angels. You know, this guy is a f-ing hero.
And your point in your letter, he's Muslim.
Yeah, he's Muslim. Yeah, he's Muslim. I mean, he could be a Buddhist, atheist, whatever, but he just happens to be Muslim. And so this Muslim guy is exactly who Jesse is insulting with those comments in the interview. And I guess that's what really made me react. You have no right to insult a hero like that.
So it sounds like it was especially Jesse Hughes' belief that the Bataclan security were in on the attack that really upset you. I'm just curious. Do you personally know Didi, the security guy?
No, I don't.
You don't know
him? I do not, other than the fact that this guy saved my life. No, I do not know him.
Ismail, I don't need to remind you because you were there, but this was a really violent situation. Blood and bullets were flying. Shouldn't we expect, in a state of shock and trauma, many different reactions from people at the Bataclan, many different explanations as to why it happened?
Explanations, I don't know. But reactions, yeah, absolutely. Which is why this is not a diss letter. I didn't write that to attack him. It's an open hand, really. I think the guy is hurting. I think the guy is hurting and he's delirious because we all need, it's the child in us, you know, we need to point fingers and to say it's this guy. And it's easier that way to handle the pain and the suffering. And it's easier to say, well, it's the big bad Muslim conspiracy, or it's, the aliens from another planet. We live in the real world. Aliens do not exist. And the explanations for something like this horror are very complex.
Do you hope to hear back from Jesse? Do you think he will?
I don't know if he will. But what I hope is I wrote that straight from my heart. And I hope that, yeah, he's a human being. I'm a human being. We have a lot of stuff in common, you know. So why not just look at that, you know? Why not just look at all we have in common, all the good stuff?
Ismail El-Iraqi still listens to Eagles of Death Metal. I asked if he had a favorite band T-shirt. He did, from an EODM concert at the Olympia in Paris 3 months after the attacks.
I think that everybody that was at that concert really, really felt Parisian that night, and Jesse was great in uniting those people. And which is why it's sad, because his persona on stage is like this incredible preacher of love, you know. Which is why it's too bad that stepping out of the stage, the guy goes on those kind of rounds. It's just honestly, I hope that he can be in life more like his persona on stage.
We reached out to the band's representatives, and they told us the Eagles of Death Metal won't be commenting on the story. Jesse Hughes has apologized in the past for similar comments about the Bataclan attack. He's also said he's suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. I'm Marco Werman. Muslim high school students in a Boston suburb were going to have a hijab day, but some people in the community disapproved, and the event was canceled.
I actually cried. I actually was in tears because I was kind of secretly hoping that people would be more tolerant.
That story coming up on The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. This Friday, a historic milestone. President Obama will visit Hiroshima, the first sitting U.S. president to do so. It's been more than 70 years since the U.S. dropped the first of two atomic bombs on Japan, the only times A-bombs have been used in wartime. And though Obama has no plans to apologize for that, the question of whether he should still comes up. The World's Patrick Cox joins me now. Patrick, you've done some remarkable reporting on Hiroshima over the past decade or so, including meeting and speaking with survivors about their lives and memories. What have they told you over the years about this question of apologizing?
I think the first thing is that survivors are not a monolithic group, quite possibly less monolithic than the Japanese population in general. Each of them has his or her own memory of what happened. And in certain ways, I think they've drawn different conclusions. I mean, just by way of example, there was one survivor who I met last time I was there, last summer. His name is Noriho Azuma. He really surprised me. He thought if the Americans hadn't dropped the bomb, the end of the war might have been even crueler because the Japanese government was calling on everyone, all civilians, to fight, women and children included, if the Americans, as expected, invaded. And what did they have to defend themselves? Homemade bamboo swords.
Wow.
So even though he lost so many family and friends in the bomb, that doesn't mean to say that he necessarily thought that it was a bad thing or now that there should be any apology for it.
I mean, the survivors are getting up there in years. Wouldn't an apology give them some comfort in these last years of their lives?
Yeah, there's no question of doubt. I mean, many people would love to hear either an apology or just an acknowledgement, the kind of gesture that we'll be seeing from President Obama.
Well, let me bring someone else into the conversation. Mary Kay Magstad was our East Asia correspondent for a long time, now hosts our podcast, Whose Century Is It? The latest episode of the podcast includes reporting by Patrick and looks at the questions raised by President Obama's visit to Hiroshima. Mary Kay, you've thought so much about history and memory in connection with conflicts that you've covered over the years. What strikes you most about this question of apologizing?
Well, even short of apologizing, just the gesture, the very powerful gesture of President Obama going to Hiroshima and acknowledging the pain and the shared history that Japan and the United States have there, already for some Japanese has called up the question of, well, what does that mean for Japanese leaders? Then do they have to visit Pearl Harbor? Do they have to visit Nanjing? I mean, is this contagious in a sense? I mean, I thought that was a very interesting way of thinking of this. This is the Japanese right wing that has raised some concerns about this. And so we're not necessarily entirely enthusiastic about President Obama's visit. But more broadly, Hiroshima is a place of memory. President Obama's visit there acknowledging the power of that place of memory, I think speaks to the fact that for any society, your past shapes your present. Your past shapes your sense of yourself and your sense of your own possibility. And if you're locked in a way of thinking of yourself that limits your possibilities, a gesture like this that allows people to say, okay, the past isn't going to change, but we have a new way of thinking about it. I think this visit is emblematic of what many nations deal with and the difficulty in dealing with the past as you try to shape your identity in the present and move into the future.
In your podcast, you interview former journalist Dan Snyder, who works on a project at Stanford called Divided Memories and Reconciliation Project. How does he see all these kind of competing narratives about World War II playing out?
Well, this was a very brutal and difficult and uncomfortable war for the United States, and different in that sense from the war in Europe during World War II, where we were fighting the Nazis. They were clearly the bad guys. And it was an easy narrative for Americans to absorb and to feel good afterward. You know, this was the great generation fighting the good war. In the Pacific, it really wasn't that clear cut. And there was a racial element on both sides in terms of how the enemies viewed each other. It was very brutal. It was fought in the jungles. And that Americans, in remembering the Pacific War, aren't as clear about how to think about it and don't have the kind of comfortable narrative to fall back on. So he said that, you know, I mean, President Obama's visit matters absolutely in helping Americans revisit their memories of the war and think about, you know, what the experience was like for Japanese without necessarily having to apologize. And it's interesting that, you know, there has been some pushback in the United States. Oh, you know, this visit is making the United States look weak. Oh, this is part of President Obama's apology tour. And I mean, that seems to lack a certain amount of compassion or recognition that, you know, decades after a war is over, you should be able to visit a site of memory that belongs to, you know, one of your closest allies and recognize we fought fiercely in the past. This is a different era. We recognize the past, but we've moved on.
You mentioned the concern by some people that one apology might lead to another, to a chain reaction of apologies, like the Japanese apologizing for Pearl Harbor. What is the problem leaders have with that?
Well, and so again, it's not even apologizing. It's just, do they show up?
Yeah.
Do they go to Pearl Harbor and say, yes, we acknowledge that we did this here? Part of the reason why it's a concern within the Japanese right wing is that the narrative that the Japanese right wing has about what happened leading up to World War II and during World War II was that Japan was not being an aggressor. Japan was just trying to rise in the world as a great power, the same way that European powers had done, the same way the United States had done. And that included projecting power. Europeans had taken colonies. The United States had taken colonies, including the Philippines, and had projected its power into the high seas. And so Japan wanted to create the Great East Asia co-prosperity sphere. In their narrative, they were liberating Asia from these European colonial powers. And the European colonial powers didn't like it, and neither did the United States. So they started imposing embargoes and sanctions, and the Japanese pushed back, and the Pearl Harbor bombing was part of that. So for the Japanese leader to go to Pearl Harbor would be to acknowledge, you know, we caused pain, we caused damage here. And it calls into question, was it really justified, or was this actually an act of aggression?
Is there a lesson in all these differing narratives of war, especially for Americans?
Yeah, I think there is. I mean, if you look at our own civil war, you know, if you look at many countries' civil strife, you know, Cambodia, Rwanda, Bosnia, and how you remember how you bind society back together when there's been that kind of violence, that kind of breach of trust, that kind of rift, societies have to decide whether consciously or subconsciously how much you remember and how much you put aside. You know, in the Spanish Civil War, for generations, people didn't talk about it because neighbors were living next to people who had killed their families. There had been horrible, unspeakable things done. In the United States, after our Civil War, there were also some pretty raw feelings. And for the nation to come back together, some of those histories needed to be put aside for a while, and then eventually for there to be a common narrative that was agreed upon at a national level. But even today, if you go to the South, to the Deep South, and you go and talk to Civil War reenactors, talk to people who have passed down stories that their great-great-great-grandfathers passed down, it's a different set of memories. It's a different understanding of what happened and what it felt like after the war to be in the position they were in.
Patrick Cox, what about the children and the grandchildren of Hiroshima survivors? I mean, they know their parents' stories. Does the narrative become more elastic and morph over time?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, they're hearing these stories from people in their families, older people in their families, and yet at the same time, they're just experiencing life, a life in which Americans and Japanese are completely at peace and interact to a far greater degree. And let me tell you about just one such story of a granddaughter of a Hiroshima survivor who ended up marrying an American serviceman, moving to Colorado, and raising two kids. So they are now two Japanese-American kids. She met with some resistance within her own family, not surprisingly, really, but everybody's gotten over it. And in fact, the family sees themselves as pioneers for a new kind of a spirit. That's not to say that there aren't problems, the kinds of problems that Mary Kay is talking about with the Civil War. This woman, this granddaughter, is frustrated at not being able to really discuss the events of Hiroshima with her friends and neighbors. They don't really want to talk about it, she says, and the schools don't do that great a job. She thinks that she's going to have to pass the story of Hiroshima on to her kids herself. But she sees herself as a bridge.
The World's Patrick Cox and Mary Kay Magstad, hosts of our podcast, Whose Century Is It? Thanks to you both.
You're welcome, Marco.
Thanks, Marco.
You can find links to their Hiroshima coverage at pri.org/century. 7 years after the destruction of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, a man by the name of Taira Shinsuke wrote the lyrics to a song. It's called Hayami Kachibushi. Shinsuke wrote it to try and help the people of Japan heal after World War II, specifically the people of Okinawa, another Japanese city that was devastated during the conflict. The song became popular and has remained so to this day. Here's one modern version of the tune. Sounds upbeat, but the lyrics actually deal with large themes of war and its devastating effects. And sadly, those are themes people in other places can relate to, which leads me to a very different version of Hayami Kachibushi. This one by a Boston-based band that plays Ethiopian-inspired music. Debo Band is the name. We've featured them on the show before. And they've reimagined Hayami Kachibushi with an Ethiopian twist. One of the band's members, Marie Abe, is actually Japanese, and she points out that Ethiopia and Okinawa may be a world apart, but people in both places have experienced similar hardships throughout their history.
Military occupation, war, famine, and homesickness that comes with forced or voluntary migration under hard circumstances. So I felt like there's a lot in common between Ethiopian experiences and Okinawan experiences.
In Okinawa, they hold an annual international competition of Hayami Kachibushi, and earlier this year, Debo Band entered their version of the song. Turns out that despite it being an international competition, there'd never been a non-Japanese entry until now. Here's Debo Band's Marie Abe again.
They started playing this track really loud, and apparently the audience was confused at the beginning. And then as soon as they recognized that it was a reinterpretation of Hayami Kachibushi, they started to smile. And then at the end, the organizer read my email explaining why we felt the affinity with the song and why we decided to do our arrangement. Then everybody apparently gave us a really big applause.
You gotta applaud them, because when you stop and think about it, it truly is amazing how a folk song from Okinawa, Japan, was reinterpreted by an Ethiopian jazz pop band from Boston before coming full circle back to Okinawa. Oh, it doesn't hurt that it's also a really cool tune. A preview now of a story you'll hear tomorrow on the show. Some Cambodian refugees who settled in a New England town have been reliving their memories of the killing fields. That's because a dignitary from their home country came to visit recently. Hun Manet is son of Cambodia's authoritarian leader, Hun Sen. And while modern Cambodia has come a long way from the Khmer Rouge, many Cambodian Americans see it as a dictatorship worthy of protest.
I had to stand up. I just pictured all these people in Cambodia that are still suffering and needed our voice to stop. Stop Hun Manet and stop Hun Sen at all costs.
Another Cambodian American sits the protest out.
Cambodian politics has nothing to do with how we lived here. They can fight among each other. We are American.
A Cambodian American community confronts its history and tries to imagine its future. That story tomorrow. New music from the Brothers of the Baladi, a group based in Portland, Oregon. The brothers, who aren't really brothers, by the way, take a stab at Middle Eastern and electronic music on their new album, Gravity of Love. Coming up, Hijab Day at a Boston area high school is canceled. Find out why on The World. I'm Marco Werman with The World. You've heard the stories. Maybe you've experienced this yourself. Muslim women who wear headscarves in the U.S. can face harassment just for going about their lives. Just recently, a man in North Carolina pled guilty after being charged with using force against a Muslim woman. He approached the woman on a domestic flight, and he told her to take off her headscarf. After she refused, he pulled off the woman's headscarf. Now the man's facing probation and a fine. The Islamic style of head covering called hijab has also stirred up some controversy not far from our studios here in Boston. The World's Matthew Bell has that story.
The city of Medford, population about 57,000, is north of Boston. It's sort of where the city ends and the suburbs begin. It's also where I happen to live, and as someone who reports on religion, I was intrigued to hear that students at the local high school were going to take part in World Hijab Day.
It's just to show you why we wear it, to make you feel the environment that we feel when, like, when I walk in the halls, how I feel, how those people look at me.
Sophia Chalabi is a ninth grader. She spent much of her life in Syria. She's never really experienced direct discrimination in Medford, she says. But there was a weird moment in school last fall during a moment of silence for the victims of the attacks in Paris.
I remember when it was like around the Paris bombing, there were like people in my homeroom looking at me. And I was like, really? Okay, like, why don't look at me? I wasn't there.
Chalabi is one of a handful of students at Medford High School who wears a headscarf to school. She's also part of the Arabic club. Some of its members are Muslims, but not all. Early this semester, the club came up with the idea of taking part in World Hijab Day. It's an annual event to promote awareness and understanding of Muslim women who wear the headscarf as an expression of their faith. At Medford High, students and teachers, too, would be invited to wear a headscarf for the day if they wanted to. After school, there would be an assembly to talk about it. John Perella is the headmaster at the high school.
So they were really organized. They were sincere and genuine and really sweet. You know, the whole idea of it was to really develop empathy and to give voice to a minority group in our building that does not typically have voice.
Perella gave Hijab Day the green light. He announced it to faculty. The date was set. But then the trouble started. There was a wave of phone calls, emails, and social media posts.
There was a whole spectrum of responses, you know, from mildly concerned to, you know, people that completely got wrong. They missed the whole boat, what we were trying to do.
Perella is being diplomatic. Some of the response was downright vitriolic. People accused the administration of allowing Muslims to proselytize in school, which Perella says was simply not the case. He says nearly all of the complaints were made anonymously. One resident did write an op-ed in the local paper. He blamed political correctness, and he linked Hijab Day to outsiders who wished to destroy America. Amid the uproar, school officials decided to back off. They persuaded students to call off Hijab Day. 17-year-old Nayara Zerlatini was kind of stunned.
I actually cried. I actually was in tears because I felt like we're already kind of in the 21st century, and I was kind of secretly hoping that people would be more tolerant.
So was superintendent of Medford Schools, Roy Belson. He liked the idea of students taking part in Hijab Day, too, but the whole fiasco reminded him that it really matters how you plan for an event like this.
We have to respect the sensitivities of the community. We have to understand that there are people who aren't with us yet, who don't understand these things yet. And we can make our situation a lot worse if we don't take the time and work with them.
But for Belson, this is personal. He insists that students need to be allowed to express their religious identity, even in a public school. Belson is Jewish, and he grew up here in Medford, which is overwhelmingly Catholic and Protestant. And that wasn't always easy.
I was walking down Lawrence Road to the temple, and I remember there was a boy who was in the school with me who called me some inappropriate names about using my religion and then punched me. You know, he was a lot stronger than I was at the time, and I had a black eye, and I had also had a couple of other injuries that went with it. Believe it or not, there was a police officer on the corner, did nothing.
Guys, find a seat wherever you'd like. We should have a faculty member and a community member at each table. So
Something interesting is coming out of the controversy. Students from the Arabic club are taking part in public meetings to talk about religious diversity. High school senior Simon Ospenson says, in a way, Hijab Day was a success.
It was unpleasant to have it shot down, and it was shocking, and it was brutal, in a sense. But I think the net impact has definitely been positive. Just because you have this dialogue with the city and the elements of the community, and also just the ability to say that, you know, we can get together and talk about this, and that it's not settled through other means, and that there is a discussion in the first place.
It's not clear if the Arabic Club will try again with Hijab Day next year, but one thing that's come out of these discussions already is a plan at City Hall to host an iftar dinner one evening during the upcoming month of Ramadan. For The World, Matthew Bell, Medford.
Confusion leads to misunderstanding, leads to hurt feelings.
Let me clear up a bit of confusion over the Welsh language. I know a lot of people listen to music in other languages and just ignore the words. That's cool, but there is an alternative. Welsh vocalist Ninebach has a new album out. That's the number 9, followed by Bach, as in Johann Sebastian. Ninebach songs are in Welsh, so to help the listener understand what's going on, Ninebach created a companion CD featuring a number of writers, musicians, and actors reading her songs in English. Here's Peter Gabriel reciting the lyrics to the song you just heard, titled Darren, imagining it as a message on an answering machine.
It's me, Dad. I love you. Don't you ever forget that. When I met you, love became three-dimensional. Love became something I could hold and smell and sing to. It was like meeting a feeling.
This concept is unique, and I've got to say, it's welcome. I love it when an album comes with printed translations of the lyrics. Even better to have an entire recording in English. Tell you what, though, we're closing out the show today with some more Welsh confusion with Ninebach and a heavy backbeat. That is our show today, coming to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston. Here's the title track to Ninebach's just-released CD, Anian.
Public Radio International.